We're going to do a quick summary of what's in the Tattvasandarbha. Okay. Of course, first is Mangalacharana, and here a verse is used, not an original verse, but a verse from the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, glorifying the appearance of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And that in the second Mangalacharana verse, Hare Krishna. I have to do some scrolling here. Jiva Goswami gives his own verse explaining the first, this is the Lord who's black on the inside, or he's Krishna on the inside, but on the outside he's Gaura, and so on. In the third Mangalacharana verse, he offers respects to Rupa and Sanatan and acknowledges that they ordered him to write this book. How is that? Okay. Hold on a second. I got to check something. Okay. Some mistakes I caught. Then he offers respects to Gopal Bhatta Goswami, whom he gives credit to writing the first version of the Sandarbhas, and having based it on the teachings of venerable Vaishnavas. So he says, this first writing of the book, the version done by Gopal Bhatta Goswami, was not altogether systematic. It was more like a collection of notes, preliminary version. So he carefully scrutinized it and put it into proper order, Jiva Goswami. Then he says that only one whose only desire is to worship the lotus feet of Sri Krishna should look at this book. Anybody else who tries to, I curse them. Okay, that's the first file. I have to open the second file. In the second file, he offers obeisances to his mantra gurus and those gurus who taught them the message of the Bhagavatam, and announces his intention to compile the Bhagavat Sandarbha. Then he indicates the absolute truth, which is the subject matter. This tattva sometimes... I'm sorry, could I get some water? Sometimes called Brahman in the Vedas and is understood just to be pure spiritual existence. One partial expansion of that amsha, of that tattva, with its further expansions, controls in the material world the material energy that is called the Puman or Purusha. And one complete form of that tattva is Lord Narayan, who rules in Vaikuntha. But actually the tattva is Sri Krishna. Okay, you don't have to wait to the fourth Sandarbha to find that out, he's telling us. But he hasn't proven it. He'll prove it in the fourth Sandarbha. That tattva is Sri Krishna. So may he please grant pure love for those who worship his lotus feet. To those who worship his lotus feet. Okay. Okay, our business, our concern in this book is to determine the ideas of the absolute truth, Sri Krishna, And the words in the Bhagavatam that describe him, the relationship, how the Bhagavatam actually describes Krishna, the Absolute Truth, and also the Abhideya or Videya, Abhideya, it's the advised practice of worshiping him. What does that consist of? Devotional service and practice. And also the Prayojana, love for the Absolute Truth, Krishna. In order to properly ascertain all these topics, we need to determine what is our proper pramana. This is the epistemological question. Pramana. Prama means correct understanding, but it excludes memory and dreams. Your memory and your dreams might sometimes be correct, but they're not reliable. Sometimes they're wrong. What you remember and what you experience in dreams. So they don't count as prama. But other experience that is correct. Because it can't just be circumstantially correct, but not reliably correct. You know, it's correct here, now, but 5 minutes later it may be incorrect. No, it should be reliably and steadily correct. Then it's prama. Correct understanding, correct perception. Whatever means provides that correct perception is called pramana, which is understood as karanavacya. It's describing the instrument. That by which you get the correct understanding, prama, is called pramana. Well, okay. We have... Jiva Goswami doesn't, in the Tathasambhara itself, go to lengths about this, because anybody who's studied anything in the pundit tradition should know what the standard pramanas are. They're taught even in the most elementary textbooks on Nyaya Shastra. There's pratyaksha. What you see with your own senses. There's anuman, the extension of this sensory knowledge by using logic. You can deduce things that you can't see or perceive directly by logic. And then the third means, standard means, is hearing from an authority on the particular topic. And there are other means, but actually, in the opinion of Jiva Goswami and Baladeva Vidyabhushan, all the other popular pramanas are just special cases of the three main ones. There are three regular pramanas. Well, okay, but because ordinary people tend to misapply these pramanas, Brahmadi dosha tatush, they're subject to the four faults, beginning with unclear perception, Brahma, or mistaken perception. So especially the pratyaksha, anuman, and so-called shabda in the hands of ordinary people are incapable, especially of touching, of accessing a reality that is beyond this material world and ordinarily inconceivable. Well, therefore, they're not, these ordinary applications of the pramanas are not real. Not real pramanas, not for our purpose. So, what's proposed is that the Vedas, which is a special form of Shabda Pramana, be accepted as the Pramana. That's the proposal. And what does it say after that? There's logical reason to support that proposal in the Vedanta Sutra, Taraka Pratishtanat, the sutra says, that means we have to learn about the Absolute Truth from the Upanishads, because speculation is insubstantial. It doesn't come to a real conclusion about the absolute truth. Also, the Mahabharata says that those things that are inconceivable cannot be understood by speculation. And so on. So he gives a few different scriptural evidences supporting the opinion that he has stated that we should take the Vedas as our authority. But that's all good, but problem is that currently in the modern times, we don't, nobody's capable of studying in all the Vedas and all the Upanishads. And very few people are able to understand what they read. And even if they rely on sages who explain these texts, these sages have different opinions that are contrary to one another. So, again, he makes another proposal that we should look for the Shabda Pramana in the form of the Itihasa and Puranas, which properly ascertain the message of the Vedas. Even those parts of the Vedas which are not current anymore and can't be found, we can understand what they originally said. We can understand the entire message of the Vedas by studying the Puranas and Itihasas. Then he cites the Mahabharata on that effect, to that effect, Itihasa Purana Byam Vedam Samubhrimayet. By the Itihasas and Puranas, the Vedas are made complete. And if the Puranas and Itihasas were not of Vedic quality, they could not properly fill in the gaps in our understanding of the Vedas. Just like you shouldn't use cheap tin to fill in a break in a golden bangle. That would be deceptive and not good way to act as a goldsmith. And then the Purvapaksha is considered that aren't the real Itihasas and Puranas actually an integral part of the Vedas? In the Vedas, there are parts, passages, that fit the definition of Purana and of epic history. And these popular books that we call Itihasas and Puranas don't have the same authority. They're not the real Itihasas and Puranas. But we answer that those scriptures that declare the authority of Itihasas and Puranas give lists of authoritative books, names the Vedas, mentions the Upanishads and the Vedangas, and then mentions separately Itihasas and Puranas. They're mentioned separately. And there is a difference, even though they are Vedic, but they're written in a different kind of a language, the Itihasas and Puranas. There's more freedom. The Vedic intonations are not used, and it's not necessary in the Smritis that the text be conserved age after age without changing one syllable. Puranas can be rewritten in a different age. Okay, that's text. That's file two. Moving on. It's described particularly in the Skanda Purana Prabhaskanda that Lord Brahma, when he began the creation after performing severe austerities, from his mouth, he manifested, from each of his mouths, he manifested four Vedas, and then also the different corollaries to the Vedas. And then it's said separately that from all of his mouths he manifested the Puranas. The Puranas are in various scriptures. The Puranas are called the fifth Veda. And it's okay. I already said that. And in the Brahma Yajna, which is one of the five purificatory rituals that must be performed every day by a householder to atone for unavoidable sins in the home, like killing insects and so on. The rishis should be worshipped by Brahma Yajna, and that involves reciting the Brahmanas and the Itihasas and Puranas. They're separately prescribed. The Puranas originally were in one volume consisting of a billion verses, and at the end of Dwarapa Yuga, Vyasadeva condenses them into 18 different books with a total of 400,000 verses. Still, even though they're different books, they're in a separate form, still they're non-different from the Vedas. And they give us the actual message of the Vedas. And also, every human being has the adhikar, the right to study the Puranas and Itihasas, whereas Vedas are restricted to properly trained Brahmanas. Those who have upanayanam can study Vedas, but any human being can study the Puranas, just as any human being can study, can chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. In the Narada Purana, it's even said that the teachings of the Puranas are even more valuable than the teachings of the Vedas themselves, because they are more accessible to us in this age. That's the third file. Okay, so we established that Puranas are authoritative, and that should be, for our purposes, that should be our pramana. But not all the Puranas are present nowadays in their complete form. We do have a count of 400,000 verses, but some chapters have been substituted. Unscrupulous people have gone in and rewritten chapters for their own purposes, and the original chapters have been lost. So we don't have all of the original Puranas. And in general, the Puranas glorify all different kinds of deities, demigods. So modern people who aren't extremely intelligent are going to have a problem understanding the Puranas also, especially when they read many Puranas and get apparently conflicting information. There are Puranas meant for people in each of the three modes of nature. And what people learn from them are going to suit their different natures, their different conditionings. Things may be said in tamasic Puranas that are not going to be agreeable to people in the mode of goodness and actually aren't going to be exactly correct. the description of the glories of demigods who represent ignorance, and their valorous feats and their victories are true, because in days of Brahma that are prominently in the mode of ignorance, the deities who control the mode of ignorance prevail. And so these things do happen. Even some demigod may defeat Lord Vishnu in a fight in a tamasic day, and it will be recorded in the tamasic Puranas. It's not untrue, but it's out of context. And what's actually happening is not fully understood. So we should understand the hierarchy of Puranas. The ones that are more in the mode of goodness should be accepted as more authoritative. That makes sense to give special regard to the message of the sattvic Puranas. But what we really need is one authority, one text that completely determines the full message of all the Vedas and Puranas. Well, the Brahma Sutra was written by Vyasadeva for that purpose, to give a final explanation of the Upanishads. Everything should be understandable by studying the Vedanta Sutra. That's proposed. But if we take that position, then we're not going to our words are not going to be accepted by those who are followers of other sages beside Vyasadeva, who are following other philosophies beside Vedanta. And also we have problems in trying to correctly understand the Vedanta Sutra. They're very deep and subtle in their meaning. They're very short, very briefly expressed. It's very often we find someone interpreting them in a contrary way. We have different commentators and they disagree about what the sutras mean, what they're about. So how to reconcile? Well, what we need is a Purana, one Purana that's actually a Parashaya. Puranas are supposed to be Smritis. We need a Purana that's, you know, just like, anyway, we need a Purana that's actually a Shruti in disguise. Actually eternal, unquestionable authority. And it should give us the essential understanding of all the Vedas, Itihasas, and Puranas. It should be consistent with the Brahma Sutras, and it should be available nowadays in its complete form. Okay, that is a description of Srimad Bhagavatam. Let's accept the Bhagavatam as our authority. Okay, so he's finally gotten to the main point, that Srimad Bhagavatam should be our pramana. Vyasadeva, after speaking all the Puranas to his disciples, and then also composing the Brahma Sutras, was not fully satisfied, and he was ordered by his guru Narada to write the Bhagavatam. And the Bhagavatam begins with allusion, not direct reference, to the Gayatri Mantra, which Gayatri Mantra is a representation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And there's an extended discussion about how the Gayatri represents the Supreme Lord. Okay, that takes care of text 4, chapter 4. Now the next file, 5. In case we have some question about which book is the Bhagavatam, the Saraswata Kalpa The appearance of various men and demigods in that age are described in the Bhagavatam. It has 18,000 verses. Even other Puranas glorify the Bhagavatam and define it, that it's 18,000 verses long, has 12 cantos and hundreds of chapters, and in it you can find description of the spiritual meditation taught by Hayagriva. Here Hayagriva means the sage Didichi. And it begins with Gayatri. That's Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is supremely sattvic because it's dear to the Supreme Lord himself and very dear to his devotees. Ambarisha is told by Gotama, or Gotama asks him, "Are you reading regularly the Bhagavatam, sitting in front of the deity of Hari? Are you reading in the Bhagavatam about the pastimes of the king of the Daityas, Prahlad?" And he also says that, a similar instruction given, that during the Vajrali Dwadashi Vrat, one should spend the whole night awake and hear topics about related to Lord Vishnu. The Bhagavad Gita, the thousand names of Vishnu, and the Purana spoken by Shukadev Goswami. That will satisfy Lord Hari. If you want to become liberated, you should study this Bhagavatam constantly. The Garuda Purana glorifies the Bhagavatam, that it's the purport of the Brahma Sutras. It explains all the messages of the Mahabharata. It's also a commentary on the Gayatri Mantra, and it's full of the messages of the Vedas. Among all the Puranas, it's like the Samaveda, the best of all the Puranas. And it was spoken by the Supreme Lord himself in the form of Vyasadeva. It's got 12 cantos, hundreds of chapters, and 18,000 verses. Now, it's significant that the Bhagavatam gives the purport of the Mahabharata, because the Mahabharata itself is a very important text. It presents transcendental knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the Narayaniya section, Janamejaya tells Vedavyas that this Narayaniya section of the Mahabharata is like the cream from the thousands and hundreds of thousands of verses of the Mahabharata. It's the nectar of topics about the Supreme Lord Narayan. So glorification of the Supreme Lord is very much presented in Mahabharata. To explain the essence of Mahabharata means to explain the Supreme Lord and his devotional service. Okay, further glorification of the Bhagavatam. It's like the sun that has arisen in the darkness of Kali Yuga to give vision to those who are trapped in darkness. Now, we have various books that explain the Bhagavatam. This highlights the importance of the Bhagavatam, that there have been many attempts to explain it and comment on it. There is the Tantra Bhagavat. I've actually photographed a copy of it once. I don't know if we have it in our collection now. Tantra Bhagavat, which is actually a paraphrase of the Bhagavatam. It's a tantra, and it's given in a list of scriptures in the higher Shirsha Pancharatra. So we have an internal scripture, a Shruti, that's a commentary on the Bhagavatam. And there are many ancient and current commentaries on the Bhagavatam. Jiva Goswami lists them. Some of them are lost. We don't know what they are. And the ones that we know, like Sridhar Swami's Bhavartha Deepika, are also listed. And then there are other books about the Bhagavatam, just like the Sandarbhas are about the Bhagavatam. They're not a verse-by-verse commentary. So there are essays about the Bhagavatam, like the Mukta Phala, and the Hari Leela, and the Bhakti Ratnavali. Many books like that, all concerning Srimad Bhagavatam. Himadri, who is a ritualist, in his section of his Smriti, which describes how to perform charity, and there's a section in that about giving piranhas in charity, glorifies the Bhagavatam according to the description of Matsya Purana. Then we have Shankaracharya, who's earlier than the Vaishnavacharyas, Ramanuja, and so on. He did not comment directly on the Bhagavatam. And Jiva Goswami explains the reason for this is that he had too much respect for the Bhagavatam. He didn't want to offend it by giving a Mayavadi interpretation of it. But in order to, from a distance, show respect to the Bhagavatam, he described certain pastimes, events, that are only described in the Bhagavatam and not elsewhere. And in that way, he indirectly glorified the Bhagavatam. In his Govindashtaka and other books, he describes such events as Mother Yashoda's seeing the universal form in Krishna's mouth and Krishna's stealing the clothing of the gopis, and so on. Okay, we're getting near the end of the first half. Then Madhvacharya, although he was born into the Brahma Sampradaya, which at that time had become affiliated with the Mayavadis, he took a staunch Vaishnav position. And especially having studied the Bhagavatam, he became very fixed in his Vaishnavism. The Bhagavatam is the essence of all the Vedantas. Someone who is satisfied with the nectar of the Bhagavatam won't have attraction to any other literature. Shukadeva Goswami is the son of Vyasadeva. But to hear him recite the Bhagavatam to Parikshit, many very elevated and venerable sages appeared, including Shukadeva's own father, Vyasadeva, and his father's guru, Narada. And they all sat at the feet of Shukadeva, eager to hear the Bhagavatam from him, and they accepted him as the guru. Other Puranas may be dependent on their authority to the support of the Vedas, but the Bhagavatam has a supremely independent authority. Bhagavatam doesn't need to resort to the authority of any other text. Therefore, it's actually the supreme Shruti. So, in order to understand what is the supreme good of life, we should study the Bhagavatam scrutinizingly, carefully, understanding the connection between things that come first and things that come after, understand the whole sequence of logic and everything. We should properly study the Bhagavatam. So this we intend to do here in this book called The Six Sandarbhas. We will introduce each anuchet with a few introductory sentences, which are like the sutras in the Vedanta Sutra. And then we will present a particular verse of the Bhagavatam. That will be our Vishayavakya, or topic, our text under discussion. And the commentary will be what we say about the verse. And we rely largely on what was previously said by Sridhar Swami, and we just cite him often. We also hear from the from Ramanuja. We also cite Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, and their later followers. Sometimes we present our own commentary, and sometimes we quote from other shastras, but not to prove the authority of the Bhagavatam. That we've already done. But to help us understand more clearly the Bhagavatam, we may cite other scriptures. And that finishes the Pramana Kanda, the first half of the Tattva Sandarbha. Tomorrow we'll do a quick survey of the second half. Any comments? Okay, thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Sri Tattva Sandarbha Ki Jai.